Okay, so as mentioned, the topic of my talk today is evaluating the National HPV Vaccination Program, but looking at the program through inpatient treatment of genital warts. And before I start, I'd like to acknowledge and thank my co-authors who are listed there. The study was funded by CSL Biotherapies, and as you've already heard so many times since morning, the human papilloma virus causes cancers in both men and women, and also causes anogenital warts. More than 90% of anogenital warts are caused by HPV types 6 or 11. The median incubation period is approximately 3 months, and genital warts is not a notifiable infection in Australia. In Australia, the treatment is majorly done in GP clinics or specialized sexual health services across the country. However, if the cases are severe or really complex, they are referred to hospitals for inpatient treatment, but obviously there are high costs involved in inpatient treatment. As we all know once again by now, there are two vaccines available. One is the bivalent vaccine, which provides protection against HPV 16 and 18, which are the two cancer-causing viruses, and the quadrivalent vaccine, which provides protection against 16, 18, and 6 and 11, which protect against genital warts and cancer. And the Australian National HPV Vaccination Program uses the quadrivalent vaccine. The Australian program started in mid-2007, and it's an ongoing program providing free vaccines to young girls aged 12 to 13 in schools. For the first 2 years of the program, there was a catch-up, and it had two arms, a school-based arm which provided vaccines to 13 to 18-year-old girls, and a community-based arm where 18 to 26-year-old young women were provided vaccine free of charge. From 2013, we have started vaccinating boys as well, and an ongoing program vaccinates boys aged 12 to 13-year-olds, once again in schools. And there's a catch-up program which provides vaccine to 14 to 15-year-old boys in schools. Please note that there is no community catch-up program for boys. Before I start presenting data on the inpatient treatment, this is just to give you a really quick breakdown of what's been happening with surveillance, what surveillance is showing us. And this has been presented earlier in the morning, so I won't go into detail, but just this graph is showing the percentage or the proportion of Australian-born women who were diagnosed with genital warts at sexual health services in Australia from 2004 to 2011. The dotted line in the middle represents the start of the vaccination program, and what this graph is showing is there were tremendous decreases in the proportion of genital wart diagnosis in the two younger age groups, that is, women who were less than 21 years of age and 21 to 30, and there was no decline in the older age group. Similarly, if we look at heterosexual men and the diagnosis in sexual health services, there was a decline in the two younger age groups once again, but no decline in the older age group. So now looking at inpatient data, in Australia, the inpatient treatment data is available in a national aggregated form through Medicare. Medicare is the universal health insurance scheme of Australia. It provides rebates on services provided by private doctors and private hospitals, and the data is available online for everyone to access. We define inpatient treatment as treatment under general anesthesia or regional or field nerve block requiring admission to a hospital. The data is divided into a pre-vaccine period from 2000 to 2007, that is when the vaccine program started, and a vaccine period 2007 to 2013, so it's a 14-year period that we'll be covering. The age groups presented here are 15 to 24, 25 to 34, and 35 to 44. And the data will be presented on three anatomical sites, vulval vaginal warts in women, penile warts in men, and anal warts in men. We do not have sexuality data as part of the data set, so we can't really say if the anal and penile warts treatments were in homosexual versus heterosexual men. Before I present the actual findings, just to give you how the data would be presented, on x-axis is the time period. The dotted line once again represents the start of the vaccination program with the pre-vaccine period before 2007 and a vaccine period after 2007. On the y-axis, however, please note it's the number of inpatient treatments rather than the proportion. So first, if we look at inpatient treatments for vulval vaginal warts in women by age group, once again 2000 to 2013, the youngest age group, that is 15 to 24 years, there was a 90% decline in the vaccine period. This age group, 15 to 24-year-old, all of these young girls were actually eligible for the free HPV vaccination program. If we look at the middle age group, that is 25 to 34 years, there was a decline, but not as significant, a 50% decline in the vaccine period. And for this age group, some of them were eligible for the free vaccine, but others were not. However, if we look at the oldest age group, there was no decline observed in the vaccine period, because none of them were eligible for the free vaccine. Looking at penile warts treatment in men, if we look at the youngest age group, the number of inpatient treatments actually increased in the pre-vaccine period, but declined tremendously by 90% in the vaccine period. For 25 to 34-year-old penile wart treatments, there was no particular trend in the pre-vaccine period, but a 61% decline in the vaccine period. Interestingly, for the oldest age group, that is 35 to 44, there was a 60% decline in the vaccine period as well. However, please note that the numbers are really, really small. As you can see, they are less than 10 in the vaccine period. So any change there makes a huge difference in terms of percentage. And lastly, if we look at inpatient treatments for anal warts in men, there was no decline seen for any age group in the vaccine period. So basically, there was no effect of the vaccination program on anal wart treatments. So in conclusion, substantial declines were seen in genital warts treatments in young women. Once again, high decline in the youngest age group, which were eligible, all of which were eligible for the free vaccine. Moderate declines in the middle age group, of which some of them were eligible for the free vaccine, and no decline in the oldest age group. There was a herd effect for penile wart treatments in men, and declines were seen in all age groups for men. And there was absolutely no decline for anal wart treatment because there was no HUD protection for anal wart treatments. And obviously this data, the inpatient treatment data, is highly consistent with the surveillance data and shows similar levels of decline in inpatient treatment versus what is seen at diagnosis at sexual health services. So the take-home message or the final point is that inpatient treatment data can easily be used to monitor the impact of the HPV vaccination program, and countries where such data is available on an ongoing basis or is routinely collected should definitely use this data to evaluate their HPV vaccination program. And lastly, we'd love to see you in Brisbane next year, so please join us. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all the speakers again for really interesting presentations on some diverse topics, and I'd like to invite all of them now to come back to the podium, and we will have the question period for this session. I think we have a roving microphone again, so if anyone, yes, I see in the back, so if anyone has a question, just raise your hand and a microphone will appear.
Hi, thank you everyone for your great presentations. My name is Josephine Ankoya and I'm a public health student. Dr. Sells, I actually had a couple questions about the Horizons sister combination intervention. First, I was just wondering if you think that the same kind of, I know that there's a small sample size and that it would need to be scaled up more to show the significance.
Right.
But do you think there will be benefit of doing that same kind of program for fathers and sons?
That is an excellent question. I would say that it would be interesting to, first of all, I'd like to acknowledge that it was no easy task to recruit our sample. So we were sort of struggling to find a great location to recruit the sample. So the first caveat I would make would be to just make sure you could easily identify a good recruitment site for such a study with fathers and sons. and then to identify two strong interventions that could be paired together, because these interventions weren't designed to, like I said, foster that communication. So it'd be an interesting test, but I would speculate that you could see similar results if the conditions were and the combination was right.
Thank you.
My name is Anita Barry, and I'm with the City Health Department in Boston, the Boston Public Health Commission, and I had a question about the HPV inpatient data. In the time period that you covered, was there any change in national guidelines for treatment of genital warts, or was there a change in the availability of outpatient services for genital warts, because it was a relatively long time period that you covered?
It is a relatively long time period, and my understanding is there were no guidelines to actually change. There could be minor differences, but not on a national or a strategic or a policy level.
Hello, my name is John Owens, and I'm a DIS in Rochester, New York. And my question is for Claire Feldman. And I was wondering, I love what you guys did there, that's fabulous. And I was wondering if you got any of the school nurses in any of the high schools or grade schools on board to get the word out, or if you used any CBOs, or if you just did it strictly online.
Yeah, we did. The California Family Health Council, the organization that I work for, we are the Title X grantee for the state of California. So we worked with our Title X network. And then in addition, we have a strong partnership with the California School Health Alliance. So we were able to, send a press release and a lot of our promotional materials for the young people in school health centers. But there's always more that we can do. So, I think that we have, and that is one of the ways that young people reported that they heard about the Condom Access Project was through their school health center or in their school. So I think we are, able to reach, but some school and adolescents in school populations, but California is a huge state and there's still a lot more work that we could be doing.
Hi, my name is Adrienne and I work for Hamilton County Public Health in Cincinnati, Ohio, and this is for the HPV study. I forget your name. You. Sorry. So I noticed that race, ethnicity was not among the selection criteria for the study, yet almost all of the targeting did target African-American families. So I want to know how that came about, and can you speak to the study demographics?
So the Medicaid population in Florida is about 60% African-American. So we tried to target those materials that direction, but we did try to include, a couple, a little bit of diversity. I don't know how well they showed up on the slides. I haven't looked. We did control for race ethnicity in the modeling, but we just got this data recently, so we haven't looked at the race differences in our population.
Hi, my name is Robin Farrell. I'm a nurse practitioner in Alabama, and I have kind of one comment and a question. The question with the fathers and the sons, I think, would be a very interesting study. But this was single moms and daughters, and I find it in my practice, the sons, especially whether they're single moms or not, they tend to talk to their mothers more than their fathers, because fathers are a lot more hesitant about talking to their sons about that. And I didn't know if that's something that y'all might play into play.
Yeah, it's a great point, because I also, we've talked about this amongst our group at Emory, that I think if you did the same study with single mothers and their teenage sons, that we would also see increases that we hypothesized here as well because of that, what you're just talking about. Mothers, in general, the empirical literature suggests that mothers are often the primary sexual health educators of their children, regardless of gender.
My other question was about the HPV vaccines in Australia. On the chart, it said for the boys that vaccination began in 2007. So I didn't know, did y'all have a different, I know in the United States it wasn't until 2011 that it was approved for boys, as well as the age ranges look different. So what are those for Australia?
No, so the HPV vaccination program started only for girls in 2007. The boys program started in 2013, which was last year. So essentially all the results that you saw today are basically based on the female vaccination program only, and we'll see the effects of the male vaccination program within the next couple of years, hopefully.
What are the age?
Oh, so it's for young girls, it's 13 to 14, which is an ongoing. There was catch-up program, obviously, which was only for the first 2 years. For boys, it's 12 to 13, and there's a catch-up program once again for 2 years, which is 13 to 14, or 14 to 15, I think. Sorry, I didn't get that question, actually. Sorry.
In the U.S., okay.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
Is that okay?
So in Australia and in the U.S., it's approved by the regulatory authorities up to age 26 for boys and girls, and the trials were done through those ages, but their recommendations... It sounds like in the recommendation, Australia is just through age 15 for boys. The catch-up, is that right? And in the U.S., it was through age 21 for males, through age 26 for females, and that was really based on some cost-effectiveness considerations.
The other bit is probably there's a difference between recommendation and what is approved for the free vaccination program, because obviously the recommendation and the actual vaccination program ages could differ.
Hi, how you doing? My name is Ebony Joyner. I work with a community-based organization, the Youth Outreach Adolescent Community Awareness Program in Philadelphia. My question is around the HPV vaccine. It's a two-part question. I think it is for Ms. Starris. Okay. So my question was, in your study, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was a question to find out whether a teen girl was interested in getting the vaccine, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if they were interested and the parents didn't want them to, were they able to get the vaccine on their own, or did they have to have a parent's permission?
No, parent permission is required in the U.S. for those under 17. So we did ask the adolescents if they were interested, and then in that case the screen would show green, and then that was kind of up to the provider to deal with if they said they were interested and then their parents said they couldn't get it.
I think this question is for anybody. Do you think that there ever will be a time where the young people will be able to get the vaccination? Because a lot of times parents are more skeptical because of stigmas and things like that. And so as a young person, you might say, I'm sexually active, I want to be protected, I want to get this, but your parent might not want you to. Is that something that a young person will be able to do at any time, do you think?
They seem to think so down here.
I can speak to the fact that last year California passed legislation that enables young people 12 and older to consent for the HPV vaccine. So go California, and maybe other states will follow.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Elder. I'm with the Chicago Department of Public Health. I wanted to ask Ms. Klingler about your program. I'm doing some very similar work in Chicago, and I'm curious to know a couple of things. Basically, the program budget. How are you able to do so much? What are your sources of funding? And annually, about what does it cost to run your operation? And by the way, Illinois also just recently passed legislation to allow minors 12 years old and over, following California's terrific lead. So.
That's a good question. So we in Colorado, I mentioned that this kind of larger initiative around long-acting reversal contraception, we've had a very large anonymous donor supporting efforts in our state, and that's actually where the funding came from for the campaign. Initially, it sat with the health department, and due to some kind of political stuff, we asked the private donors to move it to another grantee, so it didn't have to actually funnel through the state health department for a number of reasons. We knew that our contracting process was going to extend the period a very long time, and then also we knew we could develop what we wanted to develop and come back to the health department and say, look at this finished product, this is what we tested, rather than having them involved all along the way. We actually, in the whole scheme of things, the initial development budget was right around $1 million, and then it's been closer to $50,000 to $60,000 to kind of keep it going. We've been able to leverage a lot of in-kind support, particularly with the advertising that we've done. It was really interesting to see how many people got really, really excited about the campaign once they heard what we were doing. So we got a lot of free ad space on billboards, on the radio. We've been able to leverage kind of earned media through different blogs and people getting involved with the campaign. So a lot of it was just goodwill that's allowed us to extend the reach, but I think really capitalizing on that and recognizing how important this issue is to people and how quickly they wanted to talk about it and get involved and support us however they could.
Hi, Rob Brawley from Kentucky. I'm interested in the campaign with the postcards on the Protect Your Children, where you focused for boys appropriately on preventing cancer and on genital warts, but only on preventing cancer in the girls. Did you get any pushback from parents that had both boys and girls that there was no focus on preventing warts in girls? And if you're going to continue your campaign, will you come up with another postcard that protects girls against warts and cancer?
So we only did, actually a lot of our parents had girls and boys. The backside of the postcard in the fax does include genital warts for the females, just to be clear. But what resonated with the parents the most was the cancer. We went with the genital warts on the boys' postcard because that's what it's approved for in the U.S. is prevention of genital warts. I mean, the postcards are working really well in the girls, so I'm not totally inclined to change the cover. But you don't see the back side that it. We do acknowledge the genital warts in there. Does that help?
Okay, we have time for just one more question.
Hi, my name is Diana Pratt, and I'm from the Florida Department of Health, and I'm the STD manager for Area 8, which is Southwest Florida. And I just wanted to share a little bit about what we do down there as far as the HPV vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine. If a child, like you said, goes through the immunizations program and gets the vaccines for children, they do need their parents' signature. But if they come through the STD clinic, they're able, once they're 13 and older, to sign consent for themselves to get STD testing, STD treatment. And then they can also get the Gardasil vaccine through the STD program and the hepatitis vaccine if they didn't get it as a child. So that's how we not get around it, but that's how we make it possible for young people to make their own decisions in that regard. And then also, we have it's grant funded through the MERP program, where they gave us quite a few doses of Gardasil vaccine for us to administer to adults age 19 to 26, males and females, who haven't previously had the vaccine. So we're doing that in the outreach setting, actually, in high-risk areas. And we've had really good luck with people returning for getting the first and returning for the second dose. But it's been difficult for us to get a lot of them to commit to coming back, months later for the third dose. But again, that just might be something you might want to check into with Merck as far as vaccinating the adults, because there are a lot of 19 to 26-year-olds who have not gotten any of them, and so we've had, pretty good luck with that.
Okay, unfortunately, we're out of time. This has been a wonderful discussion, and hopefully you'll all feel free to continue it with our speakers on the breaks and during the networking sessions. So thank you all for coming and for your attention, and please join me in thanking our speakers one more time.